Welcome back to Coast AM, from sea to shining sea, across this great nation and around the world. My name is Rob Simone, filling in for George Norrie. And it is open lines. It's Friday, and we've got a lot packed in. I got a call earlier today to do the show. And I thought, you know, I always like to do something different. So since I do a weekly radio show, I dipped into my little black book of contacts, and I wanted to bring somebody on who's never been on before. And we have just such a person. He is, what can I say, remarkable. I met him briefly when I was traveling around doing some speaking engagements. And he stands alone, really, in the category that he is known for. He is the world's smartest man. His IQ has been measured by 2020 and other groups to be somewhere between 195 and 210. That is no small potatoes. Moreover, he's into the kind of things that we're into. He has a broad-reaching mind. He has really applied himself to the mysteries of the universe. So he makes an excellent guest, and we're going to talk to him in just a few moments. He's come up with a theory that I want you all to listen and call in and ask him about. It's called the Cognitive Theoretical Model of the Universe. And when the world's smartest man has a theory about the universe, that is what I want to listen to. And I just want to give a quick shout out. I hope everyone's doing okay. We've had some really crazy weather. Christmas alone, there were 30 tornadoes, winds up to 100 miles an hour. And as we talk right now, I hope you're warm and safe and dry. 65% of the lower 48 states are covered in snow. So I hope you guys are faring well. And I want to get right to our guest and right to your phone calls. It's open lines for the rest of the show. So sit back, dial in, because we're going to have a fun ride. Let's come right back with Christopher Michael Landon, the smartest man in America. Welcome back to Coast AM. Rob Simone here, filling in for George Norrie. And we're about to bring on our first guest. He's never been on the show before, but I thought, well, let's do something a little bit different. His name is Christopher Michael Landon. He was reported to have a IQ over 200 by 2020, and he rose to prominence in 1999, being called the world's smartest man, and also working as a bouncer at a bar in Long Island. He's developed his own theory of the relationship between mind and reality, which he calls the Cognitive Theoretic Model of the Universe. Christopher Michael Landon, welcome to Coast AM.
I'm pleased to be here, Rob. Thank you.
You know, it was through synchronicity that our paths crossed, and I just had a short notice. I'm really thankful that you came on the program on such short notice.
No problem.
Now, let's get into this. Your story is obviously unique and original, and I want to give people a snapshot of who you are. Can you tell us a little bit where you were an ordinary kid at some point? You must have been. And how did you get identified as having a large capacity of intellect?
Well, you know, it's one of those things where a child learns to read very early. He shows signs of precocity. And people just figured that I was a little bit accelerated, smarter than average. And so it, I skipped a few grades in school, that kind of thing. But my IQ wasn't actually measured until relatively late in life. So I didn't really know that I had a super high IQ, supposedly, until, it was right around the time, 2020 measured me. And that was when I learned that I had an extremely high IQ.
And you're about how old?
At this point in time, about 60.
Okay, and when you were measured by 2020, how old were you?
Well, let me see. That was about, I was in 1999. So I'll say about 47, 48 years old.
Mm-hmm. And how did you come to their attention?
It was through the high IQ community. You know, there are a lot of clubs out there, Mensa, and there are a number of higher clubs that have higher cutoffs. And I was a member of some of those clubs as well.
Okay.
experimental tests that these organizations use to get their members. And I had taken a number of these tests, scored very well on them. So
now, of course, it's put somewhere between 195 and 210 IQ. Now, just to touch on this briefly, it's so high that really there's not a measurement to pinpoint it. It's simply projected. I mean, you're literally in such a small percentile that these standardized tests really are not even accurate.
Right. Well, once you break the ceilings of standardized IQ tests, then they can't measure your IQ. You're said to be off the charts. And at that point, all they can do is extrapolate.
Yeah. Well, you've had, before you were labeled in such a way, you had a really hard time in school. You found it, not challenging? You were, just not engaged?
Well, as a matter of fact, I had a hard time paying attention in class. I wasn't engaged. What I really needed to do was have my own course of study, but of course they made me sit in class all day, along with all the rest of the kids, and I quickly became bored because I guess I was learning a little bit too quickly, and it became rote repetition very early on because of that. And I used to fall asleep all the time in class, as a matter of fact.
Yeah. So people are probably wondering, how many degrees do you have and how far did you get? How many postdoctorates do you have?
Well, I suppose I have maybe a year's worth of college credit. That's it.
So what made you disengage from the academic process?
I didn't really have much choice in the matter. I had a scholarship when I first went away to college. I had applied to two colleges. I got two full ride scholarships. And there was a certain amount of paperwork that had to be filled out because I was underage. I was under 18. The paperwork has to be filled out by your parents in order to recertify your scholarship, and unfortunately that paperwork managed to get lost. But there were a number of problems besides this, though. One thing or another probably would have conspired to make sure that I didn't return to college after my first year.
Hmm. And you think the reason is that is because you didn't have the sort of expected academic pedigree?
Well, no, there were a number of problems. There were personality conflicts with a couple of instructors. I had a couple of real bad ones. Mm. I had a lot of culture shock. I was a kind of a ranch kid. I'd been working on farms and ranches, and I had a crew cut, and very clean cut kid. And I show up at school, and here are these long haired kids, urban kids, with a completely different presentation than I had, and it kind of there was a little bit of culture shock there. Mm. So I didn't really felt like I fit in. I was a little bit alienated.
Yeah.
And, as I say, one thing and another, I didn't really feel in place there.
Yeah. But you really have kind of a disdain for the whole academic bureaucracy, as you call it, right?
Yeah, I noticed you almost said academy, didn't you? I don't have a disdain for it. Let's just put it this way. There are an awful lot of smart people in academia. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I didn't meet too many of them when I went away to college. It all depends on what kind of luck you have, really.
Yeah.
And I found that as a bureaucracy, academia isn't very forthcoming. It doesn't really care who you are, what you know, what you're capable of. It's all very mass production oriented. And this is something into which a mind like mine doesn't fit very well.
Mm, okay. So just to get a snapshot of your life in general, when you were, say, in your 20s, did you disengage from society? Did you find yourself just finding refuge in books and things like that?
Well, I wasn't independently wealthy, and one can't really find refuge in books if one has to go out and work for a living. So really what I had to do was, go out and make sure I had enough money to pay the rent.
Mm-hmm.
And so this led me into various lines of work. I read a lot in my spare time, of course, but sometimes I didn't really have very good books at hand. Working out in the country, out in the sticks, no bookstores, no libraries, and that kind of thing.
Hmm. Okay, so you basically were just a working fellow, and that carried you through your 20s and 30s?
Yeah, we can say so, something like that. I mean, there were a lot of different jobs I had, and of course I was involved in self-study all the time. If I found a question interesting, I'd research it.
Mm-hmm.
I spent a lot of time by myself that way.
Okay. And where did your mind usually go? What sort of problems, what sort of concepts did you find yourself thinking about more often than not?
Usually mathematics and philosophy. That's what I actually intended to major in college. And other fields as well. Biology was a special interest. And pretty much anything I could get my hands on. I wasn't really able to be too picky about what I read. There were only certain books at hand, usually, and those were the ones that I'd read.
Didn't you miss, though, having discussions with people in the field? Didn't you miss not being engaged in the process of developing these ideas and putting forth your own theories?
Well, yes, of course. You know, one wants to communicate with one's fellows about what one is thinking, but that's kind of a luxury, and I wasn't really used to it anyway, so I didn't feel the loss too acutely. Remembering, looking back, I wasn't exactly content about that, but it was something that I was inured to, so I didn't think about it much.
Okay. Well, what did you end up reading a lot? You said philosophy and mathematics. Were you engaged in trying to solve some of these theorems that have been lying around unsolved?
I would think a lot about graph theory, mathematics, logic especially. And, it wasn't as though I went out and tried to find problems that other people were working on. I would decide on a certain, problem that I wanted to know the answer to, and then I would work along those lines, solving problems as they came up, as I had to. Whatever problems, usually to get to the solution of one problem, you need to solve other problems along the way, and those problems arise out of necessity. So it's not as though I had to go look for problems.
Okay. And you also studied a little bit of Egyptology, I understand?
Well, that was when I was very young. My grandparents had a bookshelf, and in the shelf were a number of books, and one of those was a compendium on Egyptology. So I read that one. Well, I must have been 5 or 6 years old.
Okay. So are you someone who's really good at looking at the micro and the macro? I mean, if you're in the working environment, do your thoughts go toward conventional society, and then at different times you're involved in something very specific?
Well, yes. Yeah, of course, the older I get, the more macro it gets. I need reading glasses at this point. But as far as widening and narrowing my scope, yeah. I mean, sometimes I have to take a big picture view. Other times I'm looking more at the details. You've always got to try to achieve an interplay between those two extremes.
Now, I've heard it said by you that a good example of someone with a very high intellect, such as yours, is that you're able to hold in your mind at one time many different scenarios and all of the processes that they are involved in at one time. Is that sort of a safe to say where your expertise really shows itself?
Well, I don't know if you could call that expertise. It's just, it says something about neural capacity.
Your ability.
Well, yeah, in a matter of speaking, you're just holding certain things, that you're running certain mental processes simultaneously. I don't want to call it multitasking, because the tasks aren't independent. They're all interrelated around one central theme or concept. And all of these things have to go on in your mind simultaneously, otherwise you're forgetting things that you need to know in order to run these other processes. So in a holistic way, yes, this is what's happening.
Is that anything like predictive software, where you can create a model and play out different scenarios?
Well, models involve varying degrees of parallelism. Some models are highly parallel, which means they have a number of sub-processes running simultaneously, and other models are more or less sequential. They follow one step after another. It really kind of varies with whatever kind of problem you're working on.
Yeah, I imagine so. Well, okay, the reason I ask you about the micro and macro is because I'm wondering, in all that you take in, and you're able to see, everyday life, you've probably, been inundated with television and media just like the rest of us. What have you discovered that is untrue, that the average person might accept as reality?
Well, there are a number of examples, I suppose. A lot of people think that things actually move from one point in space to another, but if you know anything about relativity theory, for example, you know that whenever you're looking outside yourself, you're actually looking into the past, which means that whatever you see with your eyes, whatever is outside your body, that has already happened. And since everything has already happened outside yourself, nothing can really move from one point to another outside you. So it's all, in a sense, happening internally. When something moves, when states transform one into the other, this is happening in a dynamic realm that you're not necessarily seeing or perceiving with your eyes. That's one common way in which people are kind of misled by their senses.
Hmm. So you're saying when something moves, it's not the thing moving, it's your mind?
Not exactly. What I'm saying is that there is a theater, there's a wider reality, one part of which can be called outward or physical, and the other which of which can be called mental, and that most of the dynamics in that system, most of the change, is actually happening in the mental aspect of the system.
So if I'm on a highway and a tractor trailer goes by me at 75 miles an hour, where in my concept of reality am I wrong to think that it was actually moving by me and now it's gone?
Well, the tractor is approaching you from the future, right? It's not, there's a sense in which the tractor is not really the truck, whatever it is that you're passing, is not actually outside. Each state of the truck that you perceive as each moment passes is in a sense brand new. In other words, it's being determined at the present time. Now, some things are deterministic, which means that they project themselves into this mental realm an arbitrary distance. They have a world line that penetrates far into this realm. And in that case, you can kind of say, well, okay, they might as well be outside me because their trajectory has been determined by laws of physics. But those laws of physics are actually acting in an internal realm, in a sense. As I said, once you perceive something outside yourself, it's already in the past. Light has to travel from the event to your eyes, and that means that it has already happened. It's out there in your past. So when you see something, it's already pastward.
Okay.
You understand what I'm saying?
I get what you're saying, and we're talking in such a small fraction of time, but you're saying even the smallest amount of delay puts it in the past. Therefore, everything is in the past because everything that enters into your sight has to involve light bouncing off of it.
Right. In other words, there's something called observer participation. When you perceive an event outside yourself, in a sense, you're helping to generate that event.
Okay.
This is well known to people who are interested in quantum mechanics and this kind of thing.
Well, it's also said in quantum mechanics that the act of observing it changes it. If someone was blindfolded on the highway,
that wouldn't be possible, by the way, if it were already determined. You can see that.
Okay, well, what I was going to say is if the person's blindfolded and the truck actually hits them, wouldn't that be representative of something moving regardless of when it happens?
As I say, the truck has a physical trajectory determined by physical laws, but these things are actually acting into the future. You see what I mean?
Yeah, it gets pretty dicey, doesn't it, in this quantum world where with these electrons floating around, and if Heisenberg was so uncertain, how can we be certain?
Well, it's not quite as difficult as all that.
Yeah, it's a little quantum physics joke.
Uncertainty has to do with conjugate observables and what you can observe at any given time. Can you observe the perfect position and the perfect momentum of a particle at once, and that's what uncertainty is dealing with.
Okay.
Macroscopic objects are governed by laws of physics, you see, and they're kind of determined well into the future. So they might as well be coming at you from outside.
Okay. Any other things that you have discovered that the average person, you know, maybe something a little more useful to the average person that they would think is normal or reality that's really not?
Well, you've got a lot of background processes running in your mind. Consciousness is a funny thing.
Okay.
You're aware of one moment passing into the next, your conscious mind is, but in reality, your mind is kind of working in a larger sense. It's working over larger areas of time, and this is the nature of causation. Kind of tends to be distributed over time this way, so that is a little bit counterintuitive. People think they're just passing from one event to the next, and they're not.
Mm. And how could someone use that knowledge to improve their life?
You know, this is not something that I've necessarily thought about. One can, of course, the better you understand reality, the better you can adapt to reality and fit into it. And it really does get kind of complex when you think about reality in this way. So as far as wisdom that you can simply take from deep insight into reality, this is the particular class of phenomena that we're talking about right now doesn't really lend itself to that kind of analysis.
Right. Well, hold it there for a moment. We're going to coming up on the break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about more of this alternate take on reality. And I wonder where intuition comes into this, metaphysics, religion, and much more. This is Coast to Coast AM. My name is Rob Simone. Don't go anywhere. We're coming right back with Christopher Michael Landing, the smartest man in America. Yes, we are back talking with the smartest man in America. So says 2020 and many others, Christopher Michael Langdon. And this is an interesting topic because I mean, I have so many questions. That's why we're going to be taking phone calls in a few moments. But it just makes me wonder, Christopher, I mean, are you very cerebral? Are you tied to logic like Spock? Or do you have a very intuitive side, too? Do you listen to your heart, in other words?
Well, yes, of course. I listen to my feelings just like anybody else does. If you really take a look at the way human beings think and act, you'll see that logic is usually subservient to feelings rather than vice versa. Spock, if Spock were really subservient to logic alone, Spock would be nothing but a computer. A computer is a machine, whereas we're conscious beings, so feelings always have something to do with our thought processes. That's part of what makes us human.
Hmm. Do you find yourself wanting to be secluded from the attachments of life, of family, so that you can just pursue these intellectual things?
Actually, I'm happily married, and I do like a certain amount of company, of course. There was a time in my life, however, when I really kind of preferred to be alone. I was, for example, a Forest Service lookout. And what a lookout does is he sits in a lookout tower all summer looking for fires. And there is no one around for miles and miles, and I was perfectly happy that way. I guess I have more of a tolerance for being alone than most people do, but I appreciate human company.
Yeah. Did you discover any great truths, in other words, that you might think that a person would really benefit from hearing?
Well, there are all kinds of great truth. There is such a thing. Well, let's talk about truth itself. There is such a thing as absolute truth. A lot of people think that truth is something relative, that we all find our own truths, that never the twain shall meet, that we don't really intersect in a common body of truth, anything that we can prove to be absolutely the case. But in fact, there are ways in which the truth is absolute, and this is largely what I study.
How so?
Well, for instance, we all share perception, and that means that we're looking out and we're seeing the same things outside. And we can know the truth partially by direct replicated perception. That's what the scientific method says. And there has got to be a common basis for that. It couldn't possibly happen unless we all had certain sets of categories and relationships in our minds according to which we organize experience. So this is one example of absolute truth.
Do you think that human beings are all tied together by some sort of field of mind?
Well, of course they are. That's partially what this perceptual syntax that I just talked about is. It's distributed over everybody. It's a common field, one could say, that distributes over everybody's mind, and it holds us all together.
Is this field able to communicate energy and or information?
Well, in this field has a property called mathematical closure, so it contains all of its own energy, all of its own information. Everything is conserved and recycled, and yet it is transformed and changed in the process.
Is this field theoretical, or is it measurable?
Whenever you look at anything in the universe or measure anything, obviously you're dealing with the universe, therefore you are dealing with this field. Science is based on, as I say, a common body of perception, and this the wherewithal of common perception distributes over all of us. So this field is definitely measurable, and as a matter of fact, measurement itself would not be possible without it.
Hmm. So it's been measured, and can we point to any sort of study to reference this?
All you have to do is look outside. You're probably sitting at a desk. You've probably got monitors around. You've probably got a phone. The mere fact that you are perceiving these things means that you are partaking in the field of which we're speaking.
Ah, okay. So you're not talking about Dr. Carl Jung when he talked about the collective unconscious, that was this common pool of experience that was somehow available to everybody just because they were human.
Well, you know, you're talking about Jungian archetypes, racial memories, things that are embedded in the race. I'm talking about the actual dynamic, phenomenological act of perception in the present.
Hmm.
All right, where you're using basically a set of cognitive mental categories and mental relationships to organize your experience in real time. I mean, you're doing it right now. In quantum mechanics, you know, measurement, you don't necessarily have to attach a value to something. Any interaction with the environment, any interaction between a measurement device and a system or between an observer and a system, that constitutes a measurement, whether or not you're taking a number out of it, right? So essentially you are measuring reality simply by perceiving it. And we could say that there is a quantum field associated with this, and that's the field we're talking about.
Hmm. So the fact that we are able to perceive reality means that we are tied in to this universal field.
Well, yeah, obviously. John Wheeler used to talk, the great physicist, the great general relativist, John Wheeler used to wonder at the marvel of why we all perceive the same universe, why one universe instead of many is the way he put it. And that's a very good question, isn't it? Why don't I perceive my own universe and you perceive your own universe? We've got to be tied together somehow.
Hmm. What travels the fastest in the universe?
What travels the fastest?
Yeah.
Well, if we refer back to what I said about motion not being external, traveling the fastest is, in a way, a misnomer. You've actually got to reformulate motion so it's mathematically correct. But obviously light is what is supposed to travel fastest in the universe if you take an ectomorphic view. And I talk about these distinctions in the paper I've written. I think I referred you to this paper. You probably have a copy of it there, but I doubt you've had time to read it.
I have, but the reason I ask that is because I'm wondering if thought travels faster than light.
Well, does thought travel?
If it comes from somewhere and arrives somewhere, I think a classic definition of travel might be implied.
Well, what if it arrives where it started? What if the starting point expands and then the next state of thought is occurring inside the previous state? Then what would you call that?
That would be a morphing reality to which there is no beginning and end?
Not exactly. There's no beginning and end in the sense that the origin is distributed in such a reality. But definitely one thing can proceed to the next. Basically what you're talking about is a new kind of manifold or a geometric construct which exists in the CTMU, which is my theory. It's called a conspansive manifold. It's dual to the ordinary manifold of classical physics.
Right, yeah. We're going to talk about that. I just thought I'd maybe query a little bit here and there to sort of change up a little. You've studied a bit of metaphysics, right?
A bit of what now?
Metaphysics.
Oh, yes.
Okay. I'm wondering what your opinion is on the commonly held theories of psychic abilities, of telekinesis, remote viewing, things that most people would call supernatural. Is there room in your sort of worldview for things that have such a label?
Well, in a sense, in my worldview, that's what everything is. Everything begins in the form of something mental as a kind of internal reality, and then is externalized through perception.
So everything's available and everything's possible.
Well, no, there are constraints.
Okay.
that limit what is possible, but one heck of a lot more is possible than most people assume. Most people have a very, very concrete, they look outside themselves, they see pieces of matter floating around. It's a materialistic universe, so they think, well, this is what it all is. No, that's only the output stage of reality. The real guts of reality, where it's really happening in reality, is in the present and future. It only emerges into the past after the fact. And this is tautological. If you think about it a little bit, you know, that's the only way something can emerge through the present is into the past.
Hmm. So people who claim to have abilities to see in the future or to talk to people who have passed on? These are some things that you find plausible?
They're plausible. Of course, I can't say whether or not they're actually occurring in any given instance, but we can't rule them out. We'd have to rely on, we face something called the problem of induction if we try to rule them out, and we're simply not allowed to do that. A lot of people pretend, there are a lot of skeptics and cynics around who think, well, of course, this kind of thing is impossible because we don't have replicable instances of it. But that's empirical induction, and as Hume knew, empirical induction is a puddle of quicksand. We can't necessarily grasp anything solid there, which is why in science all we can do is confirm theorems and confirm speculations. We can never actually prove anything except by direct perception. As soon as we start using inference and developing theories about why things happen, we're in no man's land. We can't really verify what we're thinking about.
Still, it sounds like you're kind of open. You have a what I might describe a holistic approach.
The mind is a wonderful thing. As a matter of fact, the entire universe is a mind. We're simply not in a position to circumscribe the abilities of that mind. It can no doubt do marvelous things that the standard, an ordinary scientist is not going to be able to get his mind around.
What about the idea of this divine nature that the human being seems to be hardwired to identify with? What are your thoughts on...
Seems to be hardwired for what? Excuse me?
For the notion of a God, of a power beyond ourselves. Where do you stand on this widely held notion of God coming down to Earth, talking to people, providing a son, the whole sort of pantheon of this divine contact that we have written so many books about and people have devoted so much of their lives to?
Well, if we talk about the predicate reality, it's a characteristic predicate of the system of perceptions and thoughts that we have around us. Basically, that constitutes a kind of identity, and everything in the system is an image of that identity, and that includes us. So God is walking the earth every day in the form of men. Now, we're not equivalent to God because we're localized. We don't have this global perception, this global cognition that God has, but in a sense, we're images of God. And as far as God having a special son is concerned, that simply means that the son has a higher form of self and is more closely connected to the identity than we are. And of course, that's a common religious perception in monotheism.
Your theory, cognitive theoretic model of the universe. Can you give people just a quick overview of what that is and how that kind of relates to them?
The cognitive theoretic model of the universe, it consists of three ingredients. One of them is cognitive theory, one of them is universe, and one of them is model. You can think of the cognitive theory as being a description of the universe, which is a set of perceptions, and then you can think about the model as being the descriptive mapping that ties the two together. Ordinarily, a theory is separate from the universe and the model, but if you take those three ingredients and you tie them together, you fuse them, you contract them into one underlying entity, then you get the CTMU. That's how the CTMU is quantized. All three of these things are brought together.
And you stress language quite a bit, how a lot of this is based on language. It's sort of the key. It's the medium for which all discoveries are brought forth. Am I close to accurately interpreting that?
Well, yes, in the sense that a language, a lot of people think that, well, a language is simply something that we speak that comes out of your mouth. It's not. It's an algebraic structure. It actually has elements and operations, and it's a form of algebra, but it's a very general form of algebra because anything that we can think about and formulate obviously is a language. It's got to conform to the rules of language, otherwise it's unintelligible. So in a sense, language is the most general algebraic structure. Therefore, when we talk about the most likely algebraic structure to apply to the universe as a whole, it's definitely got to be language because that's the most general. In other words, reality has to be a language. And this goes together with bringing all three of those ingredients, language, universe, and model, together. Obviously, the structure of each is a part of the whole, characterizes the whole distributively.
Yes. Well, when you say it like that, I guess it has to make sense. Hold it right there. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll take some phone calls. And I want to ask you about the NSA and about any government influence that you have might encountered, as so many people with such a high intellect purport to have experience. You're listening to Coast AM. We're coming right back. Quick break. Welcome back to Coast AM. We're talking with Christopher Michael Langan, and his website right now, ctmu.org, is linked up through coasttocoastam.com. And we've got a bunch of phone calls that we want to get to, Christopher, but I just want to ask you, so often we hear from people who are gifted with a high intellect that are approached from these ABC agencies to work for the NSA, to do code breaking. Anything like that ever happened to you?
Not exactly, no. These alphabet agencies are only interested in candidates that come out of the education system. They come out of the university system. Oftentimes, well, what the CIA is famous for recruiting people out of the Ivy League, for instance. They're not really paying attention to people that are outside that system.
Mm-hmm. And you have a organization that's designed to help gifted children excel in an environment that might
not
be...
children and adults.
Okay.
We don't discriminate by age.
Oh, good. Very good. And help them, identify them, and help them if they are not well-suited in the position that they're in.
Well, exactly. I mean, the people, as we discussed before, gifted people tend to feel isolated because they're above the curve. They're out on the tail of the curve, and they can't really communicate especially well with other people who can't understand their thoughts and feelings. They find it more readily communicate with each other. But of course, gifted people are relatively rare, so there's usually not a gifted person around with whom you can communicate. So the idea is to set up a network or web where gifted people can communicate with each other without any academic snobbery associated with it.
Okay. Let's go west of the Rockies. I think we have Sherry from New York. Welcome to Coast AM. Sherry, are you there? Okay, go ahead. What's your question?
Thank you.
Sure.
I am not of any high IQ or anything like that. I don't want to imply that. But something happened to me, and since you seem to have such a real good grasp of mind, it's never occurred to me before to ask someone, but thought I'd ask. After college, I pursued a course of self-study that lasted, I'd say, about 20, 22 years.
So you're an autodidact.
I don't know what that is.
But
at any rate, I don't think the subject matter is relevant. After about 22 years, I reached a point where I could read something and understand it, or people would be talking about something and I would understand it, but in such a...
an abstract way?
A broad, whole way.
So you're automatically relating it to other things that you know?
Yes.
Tying them all together in your head?
And it, yes. And everything would all come together at once in my head, and I lost all language ability on the subject. Does that make sense?
To some extent, language is linear, and when you have a network of associations like this, and that is a parallel process. The brain is massively parallel. All of your neurons are wired in parallel. So basically what you're doing is you're getting away from the linear nature of language, and you're associating everything in parallel. So, yes, it does make sense to a certain extent.
Yeah, it's kind of a good right brain, left brain kind of question. We got another really good one here. Rob from, Vancouver. Welcome to Coast AM.
Yo, man. Great. I've got a question for Mr. Langan.
Sure.
About there's two different terms for the same thing. One is a backward flow of time from the near future to the present, as discussed by Dean Radin. The other, sometimes it's called retrocausation, which is a backward flow of time from the present to unmeasured things in the past, as discussed by Terence McKenna. And I'm wondering if Mr. Langan can explain anything about this, what seems to be an observed phenomenon,
Okay, well, let's get that answer when we come back, and we'll repeat it. This is Coast to Coast AM. You're listening to Christopher Michael Langan, and he is considered the smartest man in America. We're taking more of your phone calls, stretching it out one more half hour. Keep it right here. You're listening to Coast AM.